Hey, this is Jazz United. I'm Nate Chenin, the editorial director at WBGO.
And I'm Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO. This is a podcast about what's going on in our music community and generally just what's on our minds. And 2020 has brought a myriad of changes and some anniversaries as well, right, Nate?
We celebrated the centennial of Charlie Parker, of course, and also Dr. Yusuf Lateef. There have been a lot of big round numbers, including for albums like Miles Davis's Bitches Brew, which turned 50. And there's another 50-year-old recording that doesn't get the love that it should.
Right, right. Herbie Hancock's Mwandishi recording, done December 31st of 1970, and birthed a whole new world of electroacoustic music.
And it's more than an album anniversary. Greg, you hit me to this fact. In 2020, we saw big round 80th birthdays for the band's leader, Herbie Hancock. He turned 80 on April 12th. Multi-reedist Benny Maupin, late August birthday, like myself. Eddie Henderson, another doctor, October 26th. And towards the end of this month, Jabali, Billy Hart, also hits the 8-0.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. Just thinking about all of those guys and their separate legacies as band leaders. But once upon a time, they were a family in one band, loosely under the baton of the wonderful Mr. Herbie Hancock. Man, I want to ask you to put your critic's hat on just for a second, Nate. You know, when we think about Miles Davis's bands and, you know, John McLaughlin's early electric bands, that crucial period of the late 60s, early 1970s, why do you think Mwandishi is less than represented in the pantheon of bands?
Well, first of all, do you feel that? Have you had that perception? That they are somehow either slept on or overlooked. I'm curious.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's a strong affirmative.
Yeah.
And I would agree. And it's interesting. I don't really know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. I can speculate though. You know, first of all, of course, Miles Davis is like a supernova, right? You can't deny the extent of that legacy, and he was so powerful and charismatic a figure, and he did such, you know, landmark work. So if you think of him as, you know, exerting this huge gravitational pull, you know, I often think of all these bands that were started by alumni of his late 60s, early 70s bands, right? So,
right.
So McLaughlin obviously starts Mahavishnu, the Tony Williams Lifetime. You know, Joe Zawinul and Wayne Shorter form Weather Report. Chick Corea forms Return to Forever. You know, so these are all what I like to call the fusion flagships. You know, it's like the first generation of jazz rock bands. And I kind of feel like Mwandishi suffers for two reasons.
Okay.
Number one, well, maybe three. Let's say three reasons. Mm-hmm. So number one, there was a bigger band that Herbie led that was more commercially consequential, right, in this era. And I'm referring, of course, to Headhunters, which we'll get to a little later.
Oh, yeah.
Number two, Mwandishi was like a little less easy to track musically than some of the other bands. I don't hear music as anthemic as what Mahavishnu did. Mm-hmm. I don't hear music as like as clearly etched as what Chick Corea wrote for Return to Forever. You know what I mean? They're like,
yeah.
These other bands are just a little more legible, I think, to a broader public. And we can hash that out a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And reason number three, quite simply, history is written by the industry. It's written by the critical establishment.
Right.
Both of those entities tend to be disproportionately white men.
Hmm.
And I think that the message of this band didn't reach them at the time the way that it probably should have. So that's all a lot to unpack, right? I think we can maybe tease apart those strands today.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that you suggested M1DC as our focus, because there are some things I'm still puzzling out about that legacy.
Me too.
But maybe before we fully dive in, how about a taste of this band? Maybe at their height in terms of productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we hear a taste of Herbie's Sleeping Giant?
Sleeping Giant from M1DC's Crossings, their second recording, actually, as a band. Nate, I want to actually add a fourth opinion to possibly why M1DC is critically acclaimed, but not as celebrated, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in our world, we have this concept of reunion, you know, people getting back together after so many years and doing these tours or new albums with lineups that we've all come to enjoy. Outside of one track, I think, from Herbie's 1976 VSOP album, recorded live at the Newport Festival, I only recall M1DC sharing the stage again once in 2014 for one song. They've never done an official reunion.
Mm.
After they broke up in 1973, it pretty much was over as a self-contained traveling, touring, recording unit. Did you have a chance to see them at the Jazz Foundation's benefit in 2014?
Alas, I did not.
Okay.
I did not, sadly.
Okay.
You know, that's such an interesting question, right? Herbie is someone given to reunions, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. He certainly revisited material from his past, and he's revisited personnel from his past to some extent. And, you know, we noted all of those birthdays. Every single one of these musicians is still playing incredibly well. So that raises the question of why hasn't there been a reunion? And I wonder whether some of that has to do with the idea that this band, when it was together,
right.
For that brief time, really just a few years, it inhabited a spirit that was utterly of its moment, and almost, maybe a spirit's not the right word. It inhabited a spell. Does that make sense? Like
both of them.
And you can't, you know, if as everyone in the band now says, it was this like almost like a spirit trance or something magical.
Yeah,
that's not something you can set about recreating, right?
Exactly. That's I couldn't have said it any better. When I even think about how Herbie Hancock became a band leader and launched this effort, you know, there's a Buddhist saying that he and Wayne Shorter have put me on to turning poison into medicine.
You know,
you take this situation and capitalize on it as best you can in the excellence that you can conjure up.
Yeah.
But in Herbie's case, it was literal food poisoning that forced him to become a band leader. He talks about it in his autobiography memoir, Possibilities. I guess it was 1968, the fall of 68. He had just recorded Speak Like a Child, and he was on his honeymoon with his new wife, Gigi. And he gets food poisoning at the most inopportune time. And he has to call back to the States to Miles Davis. And Miles is agent at the time. Hey, guys, I'm not putting you on. I'm not trying to get more time off the band, but I'm literally sick. Like, I cannot travel. I want to push back my return a couple of weeks. And the booking agent says, look, Miles had to make a move. You weren't in it. Chick Corea is. So we'll help you find some gigs. Who's going to be in your trio? And Herbie thinks for a second. He says, trio, hell, it's going to be a sextet.
Yeah.
And that sextet idea, Nate, is one that we've heard on that album, Speak Like a Child, as well as The Prisoner.
Two just gorgeous, all-time great albums. And it reflects not only Herbie's clear direction as a band leader, but also this fascination he has as a composer, orchestrator, for timbral colors, right? Like he loves the writing of Gil Evans.
Yeah.
He's really into French Impressionism. But no matter how far he goes in that direction with his you know, palette, there's always a little bit of the blues. There's always a little bit of funk in his playing. You know, he's got this magical ability to be simultaneously like the most pristine touch at the piano and the most, you know, delicate colors, but also like never that far from like groove.
Mm-hmm. It's got to have it. And he's not afraid to show it. You know, those Chicago roots are always within his grasp.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, let's hear. This is, you know, one of my favorite Herbie tunes, actually. And it speaks to this sound that we're describing, that prefigures M1DSHE.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to hear you talk about that. But let's have a taste of Tell Me a Bedtime Story, which I hope you like it as much as I do.
Oh yes.
Yeah. This is one of those special tunes.
Tell Me a Bedtime Story from the Fat Albert Rotunda recording from 69. Herbie Hancock's sextet, the precursor to M1DSHE. You really hear Johnny Coles there on trumpet in sort of a Milesian way, but not Miles. And like you mentioned before, Nate, you know, Herbie's harmonies, so intricate and really stepping away from that Miles Davis second quintet energy into something altogether different, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah. How do you hear this sound as a precursor to M1DSHE? Because it's not like a direct line, but there is something there, right? There's like a vibe that carries over.
That again, I don't think I could have said it better. There's something under the notes that we're starting to hear. Something that, you know, John Coltrane had and Pharoah Sanders had. It's not the full-on loud dynamic expression of it, but there's this undertow of vibration that is the secret ingredient, if I can say that, that he would fully unleash with the M1DSHE project.
Yeah. There's a book that I know you've read, and I finally got around to reading it just in the last few weeks. By Bob Gluck, who's a scholar and a musicologist, and the book's called You'll Know When You Get There,
yeah.
Herbie Hancock and the M1DSHE Band. I think he does a really good job of tracing sort of the discrete musical elements that go into this band, but also like all of the you know, little circuitous ways that things lock into place. Or maybe lock is not the right word. You know, things kind of like materialize and coalesce,
yeah.
You know, like a witch's cauldron bubbling and boiling.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know you're a deep student of this band. And I wonder, what you thought of the book and what illumination it provided, especially in terms of the formation of the group.
Mm-hmm. I would recommend this book because I feel, again, context is everything. You know, this is the late 1960s, early 1970s. And not only are we seeing, you know, politically things charge and change, the music is doing the same thing. And the players that, you know, as you've alluded to, are fitting in step with this new concept are bringing similar influences all together, but they're very distinct in their manifestation. You know, someone like Billy Hart playing with Eddie Harris and Pharoah Sanders before this, Billy Hart is a sculptor. You know, he sees the full picture and he's just revealing it with each stroke. You know, it's not up to him to be Checkpoint Charlie as far as the timekeeper. That's everybody's responsibility. Right. But he is going to reveal this picture and this portrait with his drumming. Buster Williams, for me, he may be the MVP of this band. I mean, as we're going to hear in a little bit, and we'll talk about, you know, Herbie is writing these figures that aren't always, you know, 4/4 danceable time. But there's got to be some kind of groove guide to let people know where they are and to let people know how far they can get out. And if they come back, Buster has them. He's more of a quarterback than a sideman, I really think. And the horn players are a very interesting blend to me, Nate. Benny Maupin had just, of course, recorded on Bitches Brew. He'd also just finished Lee Morgan's band. And you really hear Benny as a catalyst with Lee Morgan, almost pushing Lee to the extreme of where Lee would normally go. But he loved it. And he was sad when Maupin left. But Maupin was glad to be in a situation where he had like minds as far as this aggressive, you know, challenging of where this new music would go. And then Dr. Eddie Henderson, someone definitely in the Miles Davis tradition, but is not Miles Davis. He wants to take that difficult lineage of the trumpet. You know, it's not Clifford Brown. It's not Lee Morgan. It's something else totally going on here where any note almost makes sense in anything, any chord that Herbie plays.
And when Eddie comes into this band, he's sort of the junior of the bunch in terms of experience because he had gone and actually become a doctor. So he was a few steps behind in his in his performing career. But, you know, you certainly don't get the sense when you listen that he is, you know, any lesser than anyone else on that bandstand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got some serious sorcery and wizardry going on in this band that, like you said at the top, this is a moment that coalesced and these guys capitalize on it.
Well, speaking to that moment, there's also, you know, you have to talk about Black identity in that moment when you talk about Mwandishi, because what was happening politically and socially, as you mentioned earlier, it was not just part of the context for this group. It was right there on the surface, right? And that goes down to the names that every member of the band adopted. Mwandishi being a name for Herbie Hancock.
Right.
Can you talk about how everyone got their names and what those names are?
Sure. They were actually on tour and ran into Mtume. Who is the son of the great Jimmy Heath, but a percussionist, performer, producer in his own right. At that time, Mtume was a member of a group called Us, which was one of the peer groups of the Black Panthers, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a Black nationalist organization. They were eventually responsible for founding the holiday Kwanzaa. But one of the pillars of their output was to associate African culture into African-American life. And one of the things they believed in was naming or renaming themselves. You choose your own name based on your characteristics, and you can step into that personality involving, you know, a sense of pride and self-worth and mobility. So Mtume encounters the band on the road and says, "Hey, guys, you guys need to think about this powerful music that you're unleashing into the world as being more than just music. You know, you're helping to promote an identity with African-American people, and you're helping to ensure the next generation of musicians and listeners having a different esteem. And you guys need to think, you know, strongly about taking on names for yourselves to help you. And you know, Herbie bought into it, as well as all the other guys, and they all have African names in this band. As you mentioned, you know, Mwandishi, that's actually translates to composer, you know, which Herbie was.
Yeah.
Mchezaji, Buster Williams, that's the player, and he was an incredible, incredible bass player. Jabali, Billy Hart, that's Boulder or Rock Foundation. Mwile, Benny Maupin, it's kind of a bit of a puzzle to me, but that translates to whale. And I don't know if they mean the aquatic being or if he was wailing on that horn, because Benny was something else. Mganga means doctor. That was Eddie Henderson, who, as you mentioned, earned his doctorate before joining this band. And Pepo Ntoto is the most unique one, probably. Demon Baby. That's Julian Priester's name. So.
Yeah. How would you feel like walking around and rocking that name?
Hey, man, I don't think I could step into those shoes.
That's great. Yeah. You know, a little while ago, Ethan Iverson posted a couple of pages from a book called The Black Composer Speaks, which David Baker had a hand in compiling. This was a project of the Afro-American Arts Institute at Indiana University. And so it's a series of interviews with composers from, you know, various disciplines. And I was really fascinated by these two pages of Herbie speaking. You know, it's like, I think it's from 1973. So, Mwandishi is kind of on the wane, but still very much a current proposition. And, you know, he's being asked to sort of quantify what about his music is Black music. Mm-hmm. So here's the quote. As far as content is concerned, I would say that the emphasis seems not to be as much on technical precision as it is in European music. In many cases, that takes a backseat to the expression of emotion in the music. The rhythm has a warmth that doesn't seem to be prevalent in Western European music. There's a flexibility. Everything isn't played down the middle of the beat. There is a subdivision within the pulse. Certain things are played on the back part of the beat, and certain things are played on the front part. In jazz, and maybe in all Black music, there is an element of improvisation which requires a certain amount of moment-to-moment teamwork and is more detailed, as far as the rhythmic elements are concerned, than Western European music. So that's a lot of science to drop in a couple of sentences, you know? And I feel like it's interesting to hear him speaking in this way, you know, really in a kind of musicological way, analyzing the content of the music. But you know, clearly he's given so much thought to this hybrid of Western European so-called classical harmony meeting, you know, rhythmic foundations and cohesive aspects of the African diaspora. You know, it's just, he's such an astute thinker about the music. And you realize, as organic as this all sounds, like, he really is the composer. Mm-hmm. He's composing not only the music, but also the energy and the intention and the chemistry, right?
Right.
You know, I just thought that was a really fascinating portal to open as we're talking about this band.
Yeah. It's awesome to hear, Nate, what Herbie was thinking about in that era, the Western versus Eastern, and how things were coalescing. You know, we were talking about the African names, and there's also this, you know, Buddhism tradition that many of the guys in this band are practicing, you know, for the first time, not to mention the civil unrest that is still going on in the country. Mm-hmm. All of this into one cauldron produces an exceptional work, a tune that the band plays pretty much throughout its career as a unit. The first song on its first official release, it's called Ostinato, and it's a suite dedicated to Angela Davis. And it's not really a suite in the traditional sense, but you've got this rhythmic thing that Herbie's talking about in the quote you just read. But he's also expressing it in a way that's this, you know, offbeat pattern. You know, for our super nerds out there, the time signature is 15:08, which is not exactly the most danceable rhythm you can think of. Maybe not at all, but again,
oh, but it grooves. It grooves.
Yes, it does. Yes, yes,
yes. And,
which is why I have to give my hats off to Buster Williams, man. I think he's really the secret weapon in this band. Maybe it's time to hear some of that, Nate. What do you think?
Please, please. The simmering groove, off kilter, but right in line, of Suite for Angela, a dedication to Angela Davis, the brilliant author, activist, inspiration to so many musicians and just humans, and still a major figure on the scene. And it, you know, it's interesting how that dedication actually tilted some of the perceptions around this album, right? Yeah. Especially among, you know, those aforementioned white critics, they sort of looked at that and said, oh, okay, I see what this is about. But Greg, before we go further, I know this is a tune with which you have some deep personal history. Mm-hmm. Please illuminate us.
Man, honestly, it's like, again, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but you know, this is foundational for me, man. This is bringing up a lot of childhood memories, you know, downstairs, you know, by my dad's stereo. And he's like, son, you know, you've heard Headhunters. You really like that. I want you to check this one out. I was like, okay. So, it was an 8-track tape. He puts it in and all of a sudden I hear these sounds and these noises. I'm like, okay. And then this bass line comes on. And again, I'm not really able to nod my head to it, but I'm still kind of moving around in this, you know, wild way that 5-year-olds do when they're, you know, ecstatic about something. And I'm like, man, this is still Herbie Hancock. It's still the same guy. You know, he has a different cloak. You know, it's not this Headhunters thing I'm used to. You know, it's not this Watermelon Man thing that I'm used to. But I can hear, you know, how this particular groove and this conception has influenced, you know, all the stuff, you know, that I'd heard up until that time. You know, it was the 80s, so, you know, Rocket, you know, was everywhere, but somehow it's still related to Herbie. You know, he's the same through and through. And I think this Mwandishi band is really the initial seed and the maturation of the complete, you know, Herbie Hancock as a player.
Right. I'm so fascinated by that story and I love it. And as a contrast, I'll offer my experience with this album, which is, unless I'm forgetting something, I don't think I heard this album until I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, that speaks to, you know, a difference in our experiences as jazz listeners. Mm-hmm. But it also speaks to that kind of received wisdom, you know. Herbie's Blue Note catalog was easy to come by.
Yeah.
And I saw him for the first time on stage when I was about 13.
Wow.
In a trio, playing tunes like Dolphin Dance and Maiden Voyage, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I had this framework for him that was, okay, great acoustic Blue Note jazz artist, and then also Headhunters and, you know, Rocket, right? And so there's this sort of skip in the record, so to speak. And I honestly don't know why, except that the apparatus of commercial legacies just weren't lined up to push this, you know, this series of recordings. You know, on some level, it's surely my fault. But on another level, like, why wouldn't I have heard this stuff? I was actively seeking out Herbie Hancock's music.
Well, I mean, even put a pin in it right here, Nate. You know, you think about the time, you know, when both of us are teenagers, what you spoke to, you know, the reissues being essentially a recast of acoustic music.
Right.
You know, I don't want to place the blame too heavy on the neo-traditionalist movement of the 80s and early 90s, you know, when both of us were coming of age and into musical acumen. But there was this whole movement to limit anything that could be plugged in besides maybe a guitar or an organ. And as I grew, I just wondered why that was. I wasn't upset, but I was just like, man, this music is vast. You know, maybe some of it can't be pedagogically explained. Maybe some of it can't be linked directly to a codifiable or quantifiable bebop language.
Right.
But does that mean that it should play on the sidelines? I never thought so, but there was a lot of people that did think that way.
Herbie is actually indirectly responsible for the rise of that neoclassicism because VSOP is such a sensation, right? And so, and Herbie produces Wynton Marsalis's first album. And so there's all this like really fascinating history there, but I don't want to talk about that right now.
Okay.
because our time is limited and I feel like we want to dig a little bit more into Mwandishi. But here's what I'll say. Some of those perceptions that you're describing, they were there even before that movement, right? There was a kind of perplexity that greeted this band's output on the part of music executives, right? It seems like the first album was pretty well received. And then when they made Crossings, their producer, David Rubenstein, he takes Crossings to the executives at Warner Brothers. And he's armed with an argument, right? Because he knows it's going to be a little bit of a hard sell, because, you know, Herbie has been sharing space on the label with real, like, real popular bands, like, you know, like Santana type bands. So he brings Crossings in, and he also brings in Bitches Brew. And his argument is, listen to Bitches Brew and listen to Crossings. There's, you know, there's a kinship here, right?
Yeah.
So he comes into the meeting, he puts on Bitches Brew, and the executives are so clueless that they think it's Herbie's new record. And they say, this doesn't have any commercial potential. This isn't going to work. And he says, this is on the Billboard charts. This is Bitches Brew. This is a huge hit.
Yeah.
So he realized at that point what a losing battle it was trying to get the suits on board with this music and figuring out how to market it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really hard, you know? And you read in that Bob Gluck book, you know, people are at the shows, you know, fainting, crying, in trances, coming up to the band after the show. This is the first time that we've experienced music, not just heard it. You know, this is a life experience hearing your band. And it's sometimes hard, you know, to get the suits out of the office. You know, if they would have seen or experienced this band in its element, it wouldn't have been as hard of a sell, but I don't know.
Right. They weren't playing jazz clubs really at all.
Right.
You know, which is an interesting thing, too. I think Herbie was OK with that because he was, you know, interested in reaching a wider audience. But but the fact it's also true that the jazz clubs were not interested in this band, you know, because what they were doing was just it was too unorthodox. And I think we should maybe take a moment to sort of try. I know this is a losing proposition for both of us, but let's try to describe the sound of this band live. Why was it such a hard sell? I'll start.
Okay,
so it has a sort of bedrock of like a funk rhythm, but it abstracts often. So it's like funk that comes unglued.
Yeah, there are definitely melodic fragments that are singable, but you often have to wait to enjoy them. They aren't placed at the front of the song, you know. Sometimes the song forms themselves aren't symmetrical. You know, your right. main melody might be 12 minutes in.
They would take a single tune and play it for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, anybody who comes with the argument that Herbie was in some kind of a sellout phase here, you know, sit back down. Clearly this band was not out for just for crossover potential.
Yeah.
So there is a trajectory that this band takes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sadly probably shorter lived than most of the musicians wanted it to be.
Yeah.
You know, you read quotes from Billy Hart, you know, saying that he hasn't enjoyed any music making experience more than this in his entire career. He never got back there, you know, and he was heartbroken when this band broke up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bob Gluck talks about this fateful performance at the Troubadour. You remember this story?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember from this story? Because it was 19, was this was what, 73?
73, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
They happened to share, that is, Mwandishi and the Pointer Sisters happened to share a manager. And the manager books them on this Troubadour show. And help me, Nate, but I believe the Pointer Sisters go on first.
I think so, yeah.
And Herbie and some of the guys are backstage, you know, watching not only the majesty that is the Pointer Sisters, but the audience reaction.
Right.
And Herbie in particular is knocked out. The ladies come on the stage. They have a presentation. A lot of it is girded by this new funk music that's coming out of the Bay Area. It's danceable, but it's still musical. It's concise. It's tight. And the audience just can't get enough of it. Literally, the Pointer Sisters are leaving the stage and the audience just won't let them go. It's pandemonium.
Right.
A brief intermission and the Mwandishi band takes the stage. And then we're in outer space, which is awesome and amazing. But the reaction to the crowd is tepid. You know, they don't know what to do with this. The diehards, they're there. They're here for it. But those listeners that may be outside of the scope of what's new and what's now and what's creative, they don't exactly know where to place this band. And to add to that, you know, Herbie's losing money. You know, they may be playing with rock acts, but they're not getting rock and roll money. And it's hard to do when you're touring with, you know, seven guys and a sound man.
Yeah, there was an article, I think, in Variety around that time that said something to the effect of Herbie Hancock is paying for the privilege of bringing you his music.
Whoa. Wow.
Because he was writing, he was writing commercial themes for like Eastern Airlines and, you know, and making money doing that kind of work and pouring it into this band.
Yeah.
which was just losing money on tour. Wasn't making enough money with its records. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at what is possible when you have music that people can connect with, you know, and Herbie was realizing, well, we don't have that right now. And you can almost see the thought bubble forming, you know, and you can hear some sort of seeds of this direction in Mwandishi's later stuff, almost like a little trail of breadcrumbs leading toward Headhunters.
That's right. That's right.
And the tune that maybe I would point to is from Sextant, from their final album. You know what I'm thinking of.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's get to it.
All right. This is Hornets. Hornets by Herbie Hancock's Mwandishi Band. And Greg, what do you hear in this track that points the way to Headhunters?
Wow. There's this charging groove. You know, there's a lot of things that are busy and have their own life on top of the groove, but there's this danceable energy that isn't cheap or commercial. It's just accessible. Herbie talked about he was in outer space with the Mondishi band, but he wanted to be connected, more tethered to the earth. And the way you do that is with stronger rhythms.
Yeah. You know, I think about timbre too. Mondishi is such a quintessential Fender Rhodes band.
Oh yeah.
You know, Herbie's relationship with the instrument, which as Bob Gluck reminds us, like really was kind of a new thing when he first encounters it with Miles Davis. And in a way, all of his playing with Mondishi, you can see him like celebrating the, you know, his relationship with this sound, you know? And as we move toward Headhunters, it's that sound changes. It's less about that chiming, warm, mellow thing, and it gets a little sharper and more, you know, clavinetty and, you know, funkier, right?
Yep, absolutely. He didn't have to hire a guitar player for a long time because that clav was taking up that real estate, you know?
Yeah. So the smash success of Headhunters, which, you know, that album, I think it has some distinction. I think it was the first jazz album to sell a million copies.
It was.
So it blows Bitches Brew out of the water.
It does.
Which is pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. So clearly something that bright eclipses Mondishi. You know, it just becomes too big a flare and, you know, takes over. And even if you see Herbie Hancock, you know, if you were lucky enough to see him on his last tour, you were sure to hear some tunes from the Headhunters.
That's right.
Songbook. You know,
it's
just like the Pointer Sisters. Herbie has become someone who has to at least play a couple of hits.
Yeah, sure.
But back to Mondishi. Like, how do you see the legacy of this band? You know, we're now, you know, as we said, we're 50 years out from its first recording, and we're 47 years out from its final recording.
Yeah.
And it's got an interesting sort of afterlife, I think.
It does. Two things, Nate. First of all, in the 1990s and early 2000s, two stellar, amazing musicians in the persons of Christian McBride and Nicholas Payton publicly on their social media and in interviews have pointed the way to Mondishi and the relevance and the amazing legacy that they have and their projects in the middle 2000s, Nicholas Payton's Sonic Trance, as well as Christian McBride's The Christian McBride Band, either directly or indirectly pay some tribute to that sound. Secondly, I think Mondishi is really the blueprint of bands like Kamasi Washington and many artists on the International Anthem label from Chicago. I don't think these people are biting Mondishi, but clearly they've listened to them. And if it were not for them, I don't think that several listeners would even know to go back and investigate their influence.
It's interesting, too, because even in this moment when those artists like Kamasi and like Micaiah McCraven are so in the spotlight, you still often hear other comparisons being invoked. You know, you hear people say, Pharoah Sanders and, you know, Alice Coltrane. And it's like, I think you're right that in terms of the sort of the combustion engine of the band, you know, Mondishi is really a closer antecedent than a lot of those other examples. And sometimes I wonder if it's not even fully conscious, you know?
Yeah.
You think about a tune like Ostinato for Angela, that 15-8 groove is, I mean, I feel like I heard like a dozen different examples of that vibe in the mid 2000s, you know, even in like purely acoustic post bop settings, you know, it's just become a part of the air we breathe, you know?
Yeah. And the whole situation of Sextant, you know, the last album with its plethora of synthesizers. And again, you know, pure sound, maybe you can't chart it out in notation, but you're surely hearing it and experiencing it. It would show up again on, you know, hip hop recordings and electronica recordings. You know, there's a precedent for that, and Mwandishi is one of those sources.
Yeah. Well, we have a history on this podcast of giving thanks,
yeah,
and also yeah. hoping for the impossible.
Yeah.
So in that spirit, maybe we should just offer some gratitude to Herbie and to all of these musicians who are, you know, thankfully still with us.
That's right.
And just, you know, what an incredible legacy this band has. I'm so glad that, you know, however long it took me, I'm so glad that I caught up. With Mwandishi, and I'm glad, you know, it's a pleasure to talk about them. And Greg, maybe I'll let you do the impossible wish part.
Oh man, I know where you're going with this. Let's do it in the form of a wish. I wish that just for one song, Herbie Hancock, Julian Priester, Vinnie Maupin, Buster Williams, Billy Hart, even Patrick Gleason could come back together. Dr. Eddie Henderson. And just do one song together. There's the wish. I'm putting it out there.
Yeah. You know, you got to put it out there. I mean, stranger things have happened, Greg.
Yeah.
Stranger things have happened just in the last 6 months. So, you know, let's see this, you know, and in the meantime, you will find a whole bunch of Mwandishi music on our show page. We're going to throw up some bootlegs too. How about that?
I'm way into it.
And you'll also find links to some articles about the band and links to older episodes of Jazz United.
Right.
So please visit our page at wbgo.org.
Let's go out with a little Mwandishi from their final recording together, Sextant. This tune is Rain Dance, Herbie Hancock original, that you'll hear all of the band featured in some way or another. A brilliant piece. Again, this is Jazz United, a podcast from WBGO. I'm Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours. Nate Chenin is our editorial director. Our producer is Sarah Kersen, and our senior producer is Simon Rentner. We'll see you again real soon, next time.